Good morning. My name is Whitney Moyer, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. It is my pleasure to welcome you to this morning's panel discussion, Public Service and the Curriculum. Our panelists are Stanley Katz, Susan J. Hunter, and Chris Myers-Ash. The panel will be moderated by Neil Weissman. Stanley Katz, professor in the Woodrow Wilson School of Princeton University, is also professor emeritus of the American Council of Learned Societies. He graduated from Harvard University in 1955 with a major in English history and literature, and his PhD in the same field from Harvard in 1961. Susan J. Hunter is Associate Provost for Undergraduate Education and Associate Professor of Zoology at the University of Maine. Dr. Hunter received her PhD in 1980 from Pennsylvania State University. Chris Myers-Ash is the founder and advocate of a U.S. Public Service Academy, a leadership-oriented civilian counterpart to the military academies. Dr. Myers-Ash earned his undergraduate degree from Duke University and his doctorate in American history from the University of North Carolina. Neil B. Weissman is provost and dean of Dickinson College and professor of history at the college since 1975. Dr. Weissman earned his bachelor's degree from Colgate University in 1970 and his MA and PhD from Princeton University in 1972 and 1976, respectively. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. And now, please join me in welcoming our panelists.
Before we get started, I've been asked to make a very quick comment for our guests from outside the Dickinson community about the Clark Forum, which is the sponsoring entity, for the organizing entity for this event. The forum was created about 15 years ago, and its purpose is to help our students connect the work that they do in the classroom with wider world issues around the college. The forum has a staff of a professor director, Professor Harry Pullman, and several administrators who work with it, but the core of the work is done by students, one of whom you've just heard. And so that by way of background for the event. We thought that in terms of the panel today, what we'd like to do is, I'm the moderator, and so I'm going to theoretically hold myself to being host, and give each of the other three guests on the panel an opportunity to talk about their perspective on this fundamental question of the relationship of curriculum and academic program to public service. And then we will have an opportunity for the panelists to respond to each other's remarks, but also move to questions from the floor. And so without any further delay, I'm going to turn the floor over to Stanley Katz.
Thanks very much, Neil, and thanks to President Durden, President Kennedy. It's a pleasure to be here. I have the great advantage of having a degree from this place and never having had to take a course. So it's every student's dream in life. It's a wonderful college, and I'm particularly glad to be here to talk about this. I'll begin by saying that I probably should sit down because I agree with everything Bill Durden said, and I'm simply going to say what he said in a slightly different way. Because the bottom line is that I think the best education, the best curriculum for public service is a liberal arts education. That was his message, and that's my message, and I'll elaborate on that a little bit. But, of course, there's a great interest now, partly because of our recent awareness, our growing awareness of the looming crisis in the replenishment of human resources for the federal government. But, of course, there's a more general leadership crisis in the society. I think I noticed just yesterday a friend from Penn State, not far from here, sent me a message that a new presidential leadership academy is just being established this week at Penn State University on the basis of a very large gift from a donor. It's described as a leadership development program structure to develop critical thinking skills and to have participating students apply those skills to decisions on complex public policy, societal, and global issues. I think from that it's probably going in the direction that I would like to see. My own view on this is that what we do best, as President Durden suggested, in this country is, in fact, to provide liberal education. I'm, by the way, not very worried about the Brits. He seems to be more focused on escaping from the Brits. I think much of what we know about liberal education comes from the Anglo-American heritage in higher education. But, of course, the essence of the system that we have now is our response to the emergence of the of modern higher education in the very early 20th century, so almost exactly 100 years ago, and to say that in one sentence or two, what that amounted to was the change in higher education from the collegiate system that we had in the 19th century, which was a system of small institutions just like this, which were primarily, although not exclusively, religious in character. Their primary aim was to convey training in the old notion, the classical notion, the trivium and quadrivium of undergraduate education was the notion that lay behind higher education in England at the time. And it was a highly moral exercise, an exercise in which the president of the institution was primarily responsible for teaching the senior class, and what he taught them was ethics. That was the end of education, the ultimate goal of education. When the modern research university comes along, of course, that gets thrown out the window. The goals of the university in particular are scientific and secular. And everything in the university gets changed in order to achieve the goals of the secular scientific university. That brings pressure on the colleges, which begin to transform themselves in very similar kinds of ways. I'm not going to elaborate on that. I think most of you will know that history. But it leads to a tension which we still have, and it's why we're having the discussions that we're having today. That is to say, what we're talking about in some sense is the tension between the all too readily accepted goals of the secular and scientific institution of higher education, to which we all are committed in one way or another, and the increasing notion, I think, that we have to recover something of the old ethical and moral dimension of collegiate education in the 19th century. How does one do that without throwing our scientific and secular goals overboard? It's not so easy, but it is the challenge to higher education now. And for me, that's very much part of the response to what is it we need to do in terms of curriculum. Now, I have a very strong view that one of the objectives that needs to be recovered for colleges and universities is the notion of justice. I think that every institution of higher education ought to aspire to be a just institution. It's not so obvious what that would mean. I think, by the way, it's much easier in colleges than it is in universities. The challenges are somewhat different, but they are obviously related to one another. On the one hand, I think there is a procedural take on that, that is to say that colleges and universities need to act in just ways, for instance, toward their employees, toward their students, toward the environment. Some of the examples are pretty obvious. The more difficult one is what it would mean for colleges and universities to act in a just way substantively in the actual fabric of what they are and what they do. There, I could go on for a long time about that, but I think the bottom line is we behave justly insofar as we orient ourselves toward our students in a just manner, and I think that means really to the extent that we can aim at justice as the very fabric of teaching in our society. When I say that, I have something specific in mind. And I'm sorry, Bill, but it's British is the model I have in mind. And it's one of my philosophical heroes, John Stuart Mill. As some of you may know, Mill was actually the vice chancellor of the University of St. Andrews. And when he was inducted into that position in 1867, he said this. Let me quote just a few words. "There's a tolerably general agreement about what a university is not. It is not a place of professional education." He said that the university should be a site of liberal education, a site where literature and science could both flourish. This is very old-fashioned now, a training ground for the elite, a system of education not intended for the many, since it has to kindle the aspirations and aid the efforts of those who are destined to stand forth as thinkers about the multitude. It was, more importantly, a place which fostered moral and religious values, though the moral or religious influence which a university can exercise consists less in any express teaching than in the pervading tone of the place. "The proper business of a university," Mill said, "is not to tell us from authority what we ought to believe and make us accept the belief as a duty, but to give us information and training and help us form our own belief in a manner worthy of intelligent beings who seek for truth at all hazards and demand to know all the difficulties in order that they may be better qualified to find or recognize the most satisfactory mode of resolving them." Now, if you translate what he meant by elite to what we mean by elite, which is meritocracy, I think it's exactly right, and it expresses the sense of what I think we need to recover. So that's the general attitude I have. Now, to be particular about it, if that's the case, what does that imply for the proper curriculum we need for students in relationship to public service? Well, the first thing I want to say is that, contrary to what I think Chris will say, I see public service as a very broad concept indeed. I think that service in government is part of it. But when I talk about service in government, I mean government at any level, from the local level to the national level. But I wouldn't distinguish that from other kinds of service to the community. We had a brief discussion of national service before. Community service is part of that. I think participation in the third sector, in the independent sector, is equally part of that. My own teaching is partly, in fact, substantially about the not-for-profit, the third sector. And in the professional school in which I teach, which is the School of Public Policy, one-third of our students go in to work in the not-for-profit sector. I believe they're involved in national service, in public service. And so I have a very broad view of what that entails. And there, it seems to me, one can say two things about curriculum. On the one hand, and I really basically believe this, the best education is a general liberal education. That is what President Durden urged on you at the very beginning of the day. And I think if you look at the greatest leaders we have had in public service in this country, that is precisely how they have been educated. It's not a mistake that the great colleges and universities have provided our presidents and other prominent public officials. It's also true to some extent that they have provided leaders in the military and other walks of life. We are about training for leadership, but we are about training for leadership through liberal education. That's A. On the other hand, obviously, it is possible to do specific things toward this end, and that is what my school, the Woodrow Wilson School, is doing. President Guerin quoted from Woodrow Wilson. He's known in my place as Woody Woo, and Woody Woo believed all of this, and we now have a school to try to effectuate what he did believe. And it's partly a graduate school. And it's probably best known for our Master's in Public Affairs degree. And that is indeed very important. But we also have an undergraduate program, and that's a program that I've run for the past 12 years, and I feel very deeply about it. It is, by the way, the only selective program at Princeton. We get usually 150, 160 applicants every year for 90 places, juniors and seniors. So it's identified as an elite and selective thing to do. I think we get among the best students in our university. And we have a kind of rudimentary curriculum for them. I'll talk about it very, very briefly. They have a required course in ethics. They have to take a course in research methodology. They have to take a core course on democracy, which, in fact, I co-teach. And they each have to take two junior seminars that we call policy task forces, which are small groups aimed at analyzing a particular domestic or international foreign policy problem. And in the course of their research and writing, they have to come up with recommendations to address this policy problem. They do it both by writing an individual paper, but they also have to write a group report. And the culmination of each one of these policy task forces is a presentation to a client, real or imagined, to present their recommendations and to be questioned on them, what kind of thing they would do if, in fact, they were in certain kinds of government jobs. And finally, of course, they have to write a senior thesis. All Princeton seniors have to write a thesis. And their thesis has to be addressed to the solution of a public policy problem. Now, I think it's a wonderful form of undergraduate education. It makes me a little nervous because it's on the borders, I would say, of what I think of as liberal education. But the students are so good, it doesn't much matter, I think, what we do to them. But we do focus them on public policy problems. And I think it has a real impact. A number of them go on into public service immediately. But that's not my measure. What I want to know is the ways in which, over a lifetime, over a career, they engage in service. And I think there our record is very good indeed. I've been teaching long enough now, more than 50 years, so that I've seen what my students do. My students are starting to retire, which makes me uncomfortable. But very often, and in fact, I would say most frequently, they don't engage in what is technically service until later in their careers. They may go into law or business or the ministry or whatever it may be. At some point, many of them do actually have employment in the service sector, either in the public or in the not-for-profit sector. And after all, at colleges like this or colleges like mine, many of our students are active early on in local elective office or local appointive office. They're on boards of trustees. That's what leadership is about in the society, and I think that's what service is about in the society. So that's why I want to stress that I take a very broad view of what it's about. And having said that, we do make at the Woodrow Wilson School and at Princeton some special efforts. We've just established a program we call CINCE, not much on acronyms, although my wife says I speak exclusively acronym these days. That means Scholars in the Nation's Service. This is back to Woody Woo. And this is a program to identify six juniors in the school who are committed to public service and prepared to go to work for the federal government. And we give them a scholarship. We arrange for them to do a two-year internship in the federal government. We then bring them back and pay their tuition to do a degree, the MPA degree, at the Woodrow Wilson School, and hope that they're going to go on to a career in the federal government. So that is very specifically for that. I chair the Princeton Committee to Select Truman Scholars, and this is a similar kind of program, as many of you will know, a national program in honor of President Truman, and again, to identify juniors interested in public service. It's a very important kind of program, very hard to win. Our most recent winner, thirdly, I want to say, is a wonderful man named Scott Moore, who won a Truman Scholarship in his junior year, and won a Fulbright Scholarship in his senior year, and is now studying environmental policy in Beijing. and has just won a Rhodes Scholarship, and he's going to go next year to study geography. What he's interested in is national service. He wrote his senior thesis on national service, and it's a recommendation to John McCain and Barack Obama. It was written a year ago, and it's now been sent to the Obama people. I think it's the most interesting recent statement I've seen on national service. So it's an example of how these things come together, I think, in a national in a liberal arts environment. And finally, I just wanted to tell a personal story to sort of exemplify what I'm talking about. My wife and I went to Baltimore last Sunday, a week ago, to visit our friends Paul and Christine Sarbanes. Some of you will know them, and particularly Paul, who was a senator from Maryland. We also had lunch with their two sons, John Peter and Michael. Now, the point of this story is that Paul and his sons both went to Princeton. All three went to Princeton. They all three are graduates of the Woodrow Wilson School, and they are what I had in mind. I mean, they had a good liberal education at a good college. Paul went on to be a member of the House of Delegates, a member of Congress, a senator from Maryland, I think a very distinguished senator. His elder son, John Peter, was elected to the Congress from Baltimore a year ago. He's now serving in Congress, having had a career, by the way, in not-for-profit service in Baltimore before that. The younger boy ran unsuccessfully for the presidency of the Baltimore City Council a year ago. He had been active as an advocate for affordable housing. He is now the number three person in the Baltimore public school system. And I thought to myself when we got on the train to go home, this is what education for public service is all about, and I commend it to you. Thank you.
Okay, our next speaker is Susan Hunter, and I have a correction. She was introduced incorrectly as Associate Provost. As of May, she became full Provost, and as a Provost myself, I can say her timing was probably not the best in terms of what's going on budgetarily, but we very much look forward to her reflections.
It is a job that gets you out of bed in the morning, I'll put it that way. Thank you. And I want to begin by echoing President Kennedy's comments about our distinct pleasure in being part of today's events. This is an interesting and certainly very timely topic, and those of us representing the University of Maine certainly appreciate the opportunity to participate and also the very warm Dickinson welcome. I must also add that I'm delighted to be back in my home state of Pennsylvania. Bob and I are equally pleased that two of our most distinguished alumni, Admiral Greg Johnson and Dan Churchill, along with Professor Bahman Bakhtiari, are here with us, and they will be sharing their insights later today. For me, it is also a distinct pleasure to be part of a panel with such accomplished and articulate colleagues. And Professor Katz's comments regarding the breadth of the definition of public service is certainly a point that resonates with me and probably many others who would come from the land-grant perspective. At the University of Maine, public service is central to what we do. In fact, it is, along with teaching and research, part of the tripartite mission that is really in our DNA as a land-grant university. Teaching, research, and public service is the mantra of every land-grant college and university. And those three elements define the unique and invaluable ways in which universities like the University of Maine and many, many others serve their states and contribute to improving society in a variety of ways. I'm going to give a little bit of history, if you'll indulge me, regarding land-grant institutions. The Morrill Act of 1862 provided federal lands or money to buy land to the states for the purpose of establishing institutions of higher education. The institutions created were charged to teach, and this is a quote, agriculture, military tactics, the mechanic arts, which was what engineering was called, and home economics, not to the exclusion of classical studies, so that members of the working class might obtain a practical education. Many of the early land-grant proponents were populists who saw a small elite group amassing great wealth while the worker classes were being reduced to near peasant status. In 1890, a second Morrill Act provided additional endowments to states, but it prohibited distribution of funds to states that made distinctions of race in admissions decisions. It was, however, permissible to have separate land-grant schools for African-Americans, and so in the segregated South, the land-grant system of traditional black colleges developed. Institutions have evolved over time and expanded into new areas of focus. In looking for home economics today, one would find a food science department with a high-tech food processing pilot plant working on development of new food products utilizing blueberries, if you were at the University of Maine. It's a great source of antioxidants. Or they might be developing sensor technology to detect foodborne pathogens. Incidentally, Farmers High School of Pennsylvania was chartered in 1855 and then went on to become Penn State University, which is my grad school alma mater. The University of Maine was founded in 1865 as the Maine College of Agriculture and the Mechanic Arts. In 1887, the Hatch Act expanded the land-grant mission, establishing agricultural experiment stations within the land-grant institutions, and cooperative extension, which exemplifies the outreach or public service element of the mission, came along in 1914 as a result of the Smith-Lever Act. And this called for the dispersal of agents, of people, into rural areas to dispense the new knowledge which was being developed at the experiment stations. The foresight of those who created this system is really quite astonishing. Abraham Lincoln signed the legislation creating the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, in May of 1862, and the Morrill Act in July of that same year. So in the midst of the Civil War, he created enduring foundational institutions to serve the country he was so committed to restoring. While practically everything about our universities has changed in significant ways in the past 150 years or so, the foundational tenets still apply. We serve our states by creating access to education for those with the appropriate preparation. We conduct research to create new knowledge and address specific needs. And we expend that knowledge in various ways to help improve lives and strengthen communities. I think it seems very likely that Senator Justin Smith Morrill of Vermont would be pleased to know that his vision has endured in the way it has. When we think about outreach or public service as a component of the land-grant mission, many of us think first about cooperative extension, which vividly portrays that kind of work. And here is a very real example from Maine. In 2008, the UMaine Cooperative Extension people saved our state's potato crop. Now, I admit, that's a bit of hyperbole, but it was very significant. Weather conditions led to very serious concerns about late blight, which is a fungal disease that caused the Irish potato famine in the late 1840s. And a combination of our extension and experiment station faculty attacked the problem, armed with computer modeling capability and other contemporary tools. And they worked very aggressively with growers and others to preserve the crop, which was in serious danger. The estimated value of the UMaine work in terms of preserving that crop is at least $15 million, and that's a pretty good return on Maine's investment in its public university system. Extension is far more than agriculture, of course. In Maine and in most states, the extension role has expanded to include programming to help people start and maintain small businesses, to learn parenting skills, to learn about nutrition and health, to provide direct care to older citizens, and to work with youth programs. It is wide-ranging, it is extremely effective, and it represents the core sensibility of the land-grant university serving the public. Within these focus areas are many opportunities for participation by University of Maine students, and so I have two examples here. We have students from our School of Economics. They're working with extension faculty throughout the state in a financial literacy program. We also have university students working with the 4-H programs to provide an on-campus experience for disadvantaged middle school youth and focus on promoting STEM fields. There are many more I could list, but in all cases, the opportunity to extend out from campus and the formal classroom instruction has a multiplier effect in terms of learning. Students see that what they are doing makes a difference, and it enriches their experience many times over. In a general sense, it is reasonable to say that the land-grant model's unique mechanisms for linking academic and research programs to societal help lead many of our students to thinking about public service. Helping others, serving in a meaningful way, is essentially built into what land-grant universities are all about. After all this time, dating back to the Civil War, we have learned that one of the most significant means of attracting capable students to public service is to provide them with informed, relevant instruction. In this context, land-grant universities are uniquely positioned to link their curricular structure with the public service aspect of the university's engagement with the community, state, and nation. Motivated by the desire to attract additional funding from state and federal agencies to support their technical and professional programs, land-grant universities have continually updated and refined their programs. And with proper motivation, that same approach could be applied to public service education and training. Now, I gave two examples of how students participate in outreach associated with cooperative extension. But I could also give examples embedded within our academic colleges, not extension-related. Students in our taxation class that help community members with their tax returns. Civil engineering student teams doing projects that serve the specific needs of local communities, such as developing a snow removal plan, which is very good today because we're having a blizzard in Maine, actually, or designing a new wastewater treatment plant. Or we have music students who teach in a local Montessori school as part of their formal curriculum. Certainly, and for good reason, we think of public service careers in terms of public employment, usually in government. And those careers are critical, especially as was referred to earlier with the looming bulge of retirements coming up. Government service does need to be one focus moving forward as we work on programs related to public service. But we can also draw lessons from a broader historical perspective on what public service is, and perhaps we can take valuable lessons from past successes and apply them in new and meaningful ways. From the perspective of Maine and that of most rural universities, I suspect, we have a particularly strong history of educating and graduating service-oriented students in fields like science, agriculture, and the natural resources. The USDA understands this, and I think their 1890 National Scholars Program, which provides scholarships through a partnership with the historically black land-grant universities, is a very good example. Through this partnership, the USDA provides scholarships, summer employment opportunities, and several other benefits to students studying agriculture, food science, natural resources, and related disciplines. This requires a significant investment on the part of USDA, but the rewards are extraordinary, and it is the kind of model that we could explore as we continue to expand the land-grant concept as it relates to various forms of public service. We are thinking about these things, and next month, our Career Center in Maine will host a session in collaboration with the Annenberg Speakers Bureau of the Partnership for Public Service about careers in the federal government. Because as we've heard, the federal government is the nation's largest employer with over 1.8 million employees. And these sessions are always very attractive to our own University of Maine students. We believe that UMaine is the type of university that values its role as a community member. And it's what we hope to pass along to our students. We were very pleased to be recognized in late 2008 by the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching as one of 76 institutions to receive its community engagement classification, which relates to curricular engagement, outreach, and partnerships. It is a feather in our cap, and it gives us encouragement that we are one of the land-grant universities that is on the right track, moving our public service model to one that will continue to satisfy the needs of our students while providing generations of public servants who will live up to the lofty expectations of those who have gone before in working to serve the public good. All of us in higher education, be it public or private, need to evaluate the opportunities we're presenting to our students. What is important is to provide a diverse and thoughtful array of options for public service experiences that intercalate with the curriculum in a way that is seamless, making the on-campus and the off-campus experiences interdependent and holistic. Only then, I think, will we be making the best use of our most precious commodity, which is human talent. Thank you.
I don't have any corrections in the introduction to Chris Ash, so we'll turn the floor over to him.
There are brochures coming around so that if you get bored while I'm talking, you'll have some pictures to look at. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I kind of feel like I crashed this party a little bit because one day, a couple months ago, I get these little Google alerts anytime the words Public Service Academy appear on the web. I just kind of feel like it's my little beeper. And I heard about this conference, which started out saying, you know, in the context of the creation or calls for the creation of a National Public Service Academy, we're hosting this conference and so on and so forth. And I said, well, wow, that's very interesting. I'd never heard about it, and here I am. I'm the one leading this effort to create the National Public Service Academy. And so I wrote Dr. Durden, and he graciously offered to bring me here and be part of this panel. So I appreciate the opportunity to tell everyone a little bit about what this idea is, because it's often subject to misinterpretation, and answer questions. So I certainly hope that at the end of this we'll have an opportunity to ask questions, as well as all day long. I certainly will be here all day, and I'd love to meet many of you to talk in more detail about it. So first of all, what is it? What is this big idea? And the big idea is to create a civilian West Point, a civilian counterpart to the Military Service Academy. So this would be a federally funded four-year college where a student would go to get his or her BA or BS, and it would be a free education, so they'd graduate debt-free in exchange for a commitment to serve for 5 years at the local, state, or national levels in a public institution, a public agency, basically government. And I want to step aside, since this was brought up by the first couple speakers, about the definition of public service, because I come out of the nonprofit world. It's where I've spent most of my adult life. I did Teach for America for 3 years, taught public school in rural Mississippi, Sunflower County, Mississippi, home of both Fannie Lou Hamer and James Eastland, for those of you who know your civil rights history. And after 3 years of teaching, I was very frustrated with the low expectations in the public school system, so I got together with a friend of mine, and we created a nonprofit institution, a nonprofit organization that would provide all the extracurricular programs, all the academic enrichment, all the things that we thought our students deserved, but weren't getting in the public system. So I ran that program for 7 years before launching the Public Service Academy. So I believe very, very strongly in the power and the importance of the nonprofit sector. And actually, when I first started thinking about a Public Service Academy, I thought, well, sure, we would have students go into nonprofit organizations. That could be where they could do their service afterward. Because I share this very broad sense of what public service is. But in the context of this institution, the more I thought about it, the more research we did, the more feedback we received on our proposal, the more we learned about the depth of the problem in the public sector, and the more I understood the cultural issue that's at hand here, the cultural rejection of public sector work, by and large, that's happened in the past couple generations, the idea that government is always the problem. And the scariest words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help, right? This culture that many of us have lived through and young people have kind of instilled has meant that when you say public service on campus, and certainly when Barack Obama often talks about it, he's talking primarily, and students often hear community service or national service. They hear volunteering. They think short-term, low-paid or volunteer stints of service, like the Peace Corps or Teach for America, also like AmeriCorps, but also working on a Saturday afternoon for Habitat. This is what this generation thinks of when they think of public service. And again, those are very important endeavors. They're extremely important to the vitality of our nation. They are not, however, a substitute for strong and effective government. They are not a solution to the problem of dysfunction in government. And so I think it's important to kind of reassert this sense of public service as working in government to try to counteract several decades worth of belittlement. So I just wanted to put an aside there about why we're focusing with this institution that is funded by the federal government, why we are focusing on public sector work. It's not to dismiss the importance of the wide range of service opportunities. Okay, so how would this Public Service Academy work? Well, let's say you're a high school senior and you're looking at the options there, and you're very service-oriented, you want to serve your country, you want to be part of something larger than yourself, and you look at the options that are out there, and when you hear about service to country, you might think, oh, well the federal government, or the government will offer an institution where I can serve my country. And the federal government does. It actually offers five. The president earlier mentioned four of them, that he left out the Merchant Marine Academy, but there are five military service academies where you can go and get a free education in return for a commitment to serve in the military. And that's fantastic. They are wonderful institutions if you're interested in a military career, if you want to become a military leader. But what if you don't? What if you don't want to go into the military service as a career? What if you want to serve your country, you want to go to this same kind of service-oriented institution, but you're not interested in the military? Well, the federal government says, sorry, we don't offer anything. And what's interesting is those five military service academies are overwhelmed with applicants. It's harder to get into those military academies than to get into almost any institution, any higher education institution in the country. They are swamped with applicants. But you know what's even more interesting about that? Is that they are the five most male-dominated campuses in the country. 85% of the student body, collectively, at the five military academies, are male. Now, that's particularly interesting given that 60% of college students, or almost 60% of college students today, are female. So you have this situation where the federal government fully supports only five educational institutions of higher education. They are the most male-dominated institutions in the country. And these institutions are swamped with applicants, even though their applicant pool is very narrow. Obviously, if they're getting 85% male students, their applicant pool is overwhelmingly male, when the applicant pool overall for colleges is predominantly female. And our internal research has shown, and our polling has shown, that young women are overwhelmingly in favor of this kind of creating this kind of institution. Because if you look at Teach for America, 70%+ female, Peace Corps, City Year, AmeriCorps, overwhelmingly female. So there are young women who want to serve, but they want to serve in a civilian capacity. This would be an opportunity. We would go out, Public Service Academy recruiters would go out with the military academies because we have already established very strong relationships with the service academies. They're very supportive of our efforts. I actually spent this last weekend at the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, where I was invited to speak as part of their conference on character and leadership development, because they see in us not a threat, not an institution that's going to take away their students, but as another opportunity, another way for young people to serve. I know Susan was talking about the buffet, you know, that higher education or service opportunities like a buffet table. Well, they see this as another nutritious entree, you know, and they don't see us as a threat. So they've been working very closely with us to develop our blueprint. And they said, look, when we go out on our recruiting trips, and the military academies go to every high school in the country, and they recruit heavily in many places that some of our elite schools never venture. And they go out and they recruit students from all across this country, and they said, you'll come along with us. You'll have Public Service Academy recruiters going to every high school in the country talking about public service in a different kind of way, raising the visibility and prestige, saying, look, okay, you're smart, you're strong, you're tough. Well, are you tough enough for Uncle Sam? Are you tough enough to serve your country? Well, if you are, you should apply to the Public Service Academy. And really appeal to young people's sense that I want to do something real. I want to serve my country. I don't just want to go to school and get a degree. I want to do something with myself. That doesn't mean they necessarily want to go in the military, but they would serve if they had a civilian option. So they would go through the same kind of congressional nomination process that Service Academy cadets have to go through. And then they would go through a competitive admissions process. If they get in, if they make it through, they get that free education. We would have a unique curriculum whose outlines we've already designed in our blueprint. And I encourage you to download a copy on the web. And contrary to what we often are criticized for, what we advocate is, indeed, a broad liberal arts education. I'm very old-fashioned. I like, you know, I, I, I'm a historian, so that says something. But we trace our idea for this institution back to the founding generation. We believe very strongly in having a broad liberal arts education. That's why we've designed the curriculum to emphasize three basic facets. One being civics. No matter what the student's major, all students would have a broad array of required civics classes, everything from American history and government to economics, constitutional law, and so forth. All students would have to master a foreign language and study abroad. All students would have to take leadership education classes, which would include ethics, as well as an extracurricular leadership development program. So much of their first 2 years would actually be spent in core curricular classes. They would then choose a liberal arts degree. Could be English, could be biology. But they would also choose a field, a public service field. And we've identified six areas of critical need, including education, healthcare, energy and environment, foreign affairs. They would do internships in this field. They would do coursework in this field. And that's the field in which they would be placed for their five-year service commitment following graduation. Now, how can we do all this? It sounds like a whole lot of stuff being thrown on students, a two-year core curriculum, internships, study abroad, et cetera. Well, part of the way is that we have a year-round curriculum, like the military academies do. So students essentially would have no time off. Well, maybe a week or two here and there. But like the military academies, the idea is if the American people are investing in you and in your development as a future leader, then you need to be held to a higher standard. And so you will have more requirements. You will have less time off. You will be held to a higher set of expectations. And part of the idea there, again, is to instill this idea that if you're going into public service, then we need you to be the best you could possibly can be. Because that's what our government needs. That's what our people need. That's what public service means. And in the process, by creating this flagship institution, again, we're raising the visibility, we're raising the prestige, and over time, we're transforming the culture. And that's ultimately what it's about. It's about transforming the culture, because we think this institution would be far different from anything that currently exists. It would be a different entree at the buffet table, so that students would have another choice. And that's not to say that what goes on at Princeton or the University of Maine or here at Dickinson or anywhere else isn't good. You all will still get plenty of applicants, don't worry. But we think that there would be a number of students who would see this as an appealing option. And it is different. It's unlike anything that currently exists in higher ed. First of all, in its focus on the public sector. There is no college in the country that focuses on the public sector. And that's fine. There's no reason why Dickinson or the University of Maine should focus solely on the public sector. Your missions are broader, and they should be. Our mission is a bit narrower, and we think it should be as well, but that makes it different. Our curriculum would be different than anything that currently exists. The intensity and the culture that comes out of that intensity, that culture of service, the bonds that would be forged among the students, that's going to be different than any civilian university. The five-year required commitment after college, there's no college in the country except for the military academies that has that. That's different. Most importantly, what's different is the symbolism. As a national institution, the Public Service Academy would be symbolic in a way that it couldn't be if it was just a scholarship program or if it was a program on an existing university campus. The power of an institution is hard to overestimate. I'll often go to college campuses and I'll talk, and invariably during the question and answer period, people will say, well, this sounds great, but it's expensive to build a campus, and why don't we do a scholarship program on the ROTC model? And then the students could take their federal money and go to Princeton, the University of Maine, or Dickinson, or wherever, in return for a commitment to serve elsewhere. And I say, well, that's fine. We have no problem with a public service scholarship program. We're very supportive of the Roosevelt Scholarship Program, which came about in part as a response to the Public Service Academy. And we're very supportive of those efforts. We worked with a partnership for public service as part of the Service Nation Coalition to make sure that public service, government service, is part of that definition. But I say there are already any number of scholarships that do this. right? We've heard of the Truman, and the Truman Scholarship is a fantastic program. We had two Truman Scholars on our staff last summer. Scott Moore, who was mentioned earlier, is actually part of our National Youth Council, has written op-eds for us and on our behalf. He's very supportive of this effort. 40 Truman Scholars from the class of 2007 wrote basically a call to action, calling on Congress to pass the Public Service Academy that was published on July 4th in the Independence, Missouri newspaper. They're nothing if not symbolic, those young people. So we believe very strongly in the Truman Program. But there's also the Goldwater Program, the Fritz Hollings Program, the Gilman Scholarship, the Federal Cyber Service Scholarship. And I can imagine, as I go through the list, fewer and fewer of you would know what they are. And that's the problem, is that yes, you can create another scholarship program that a few very interested people know about, but you don't have the symbolic power. I'll go around and I'll ask a group full of college graduates, how many of you have heard of the Truman Scholarship? Maybe half will say yes. Then I'll say, what about the Fritz Hollings Scholarship? Hardly any. And I'll say, what about the Federal Cyber Service Scholarship? What about the Goldwater Scholarship? What about the Pickering Scholarship? And fewer do. And then I'll say, well, how many of you have heard of West Point? Every hand goes up. How many of you heard of the Naval Academy? Every hand goes up, because there's something about an institution that can weave itself into the fabric of this nation, that can transform the culture, that is not true of a scholarship program. So we think that this is an important addition to the landscape of American higher education. We get a lot of support from young people. And as President Guerin was talking about earlier, this is a unique time. This is the moment. Between the economic crisis, the new administration, this new sense of service and commitment that's come about, not just because of Barack Obama, but going back to 9/11. This is the time. And if all we get out of this time is a tweak in the tax code or another little service scholarship, it would be a terrible wasted opportunity. This is the opportunity we have to create an enduring national institution that will generate generation after generation of young people committed to serve the nation in the public sector. And I'm happy to answer questions.
A whole lot of issues that could be raised here, hopefully we'll have some time over the course of the day to respond to a lot of the comments that have been made. But maybe since this particular panel is supposed to focus on curriculum, let me just ask a question that in my mind arises from the different perspectives that our speakers gave on this, and hopefully it'll yield some conversation. I think that there is something of a contrast between two visions of what a curriculum or the curriculum for public service might be. And that really is the notion of whether or not, and I think the Public Service Academy embodies this, whether or not one should try to envision a curriculum to train public servants. Whether there is this, in the case of the Public Service Academy, a combination of what we would probably call civics, American government, ethics, leadership courses, a set of courses that can be put together that are an effective way to educate for the kind of public service that American democracy might want. And by the way, you know, the curriculum you build has to be reflecting the image of what you want at the end, the kind of public service that America wants, and implicit in the Public Service Academy notion is a model that is partly military, and it's a good issue there. So is there a curriculum? Or on the other hand, are we thinking about American public service, does it point in the direction that most American colleges and universities have taken, as our speakers have pointed out, of a much more pluralistic view, that in fact a broad general liberal arts approach to things is the right way to approach this, with lots of flexibility for a public service that might be envisioned more in terms of pluralism and multiple technical needs and students with the ability to tie together insights from different fields, with the turn to public service not being the curriculum, but really a consequence of specialized programs, internship opportunities, and the like. So let me just stop with that and ask the panelists to reflect on that.
You know, as I was listening to Chris speak and thinking about, you talked about a liberal arts curriculum as really being the core, but I worry a little bit, or I have to challenge a little bit, the idea that, that the academy coming out with a liberal arts curriculum, basically every single person is coming at it the same way. It's a core, it's a body of knowledge which is appropriate perhaps for the military. I see it as a little different when we're talking about public service, where I think what we benefit from is sort of the all points of the compass approach that is really what happens if you look nationwide in terms of the liberal arts educations that are delivered in literally thousands of different places. In terms of what that, the output in terms of the human capital is very enriched because of that.
I was fascinated to hear about this. I don't only heard vaguely about the Academy before, and I certainly haven't had time to think about it. I have very much the same reaction, just talking about curriculum, not about the other aspects of it. It troubles me. Most of what you have outlined, if I understand it correctly, is really very much what other liberal arts institutions are doing. The one element that seems to me perhaps a little different is leadership studies. My comment on that would be, a lot of colleges and universities are interested in doing more with that now. I don't think it's something, as educators, we understand very well, and I don't think we do yet, at any rate, a very good job on it. We have developed a couple of courses. I don't have, frankly, great confidence in them, but maybe that's something we can do, so that it looks to me as though the, and you have emphasized, that the general aims are a broad liberal education. In that context, the, you know, the analogy you keep coming back to, West Point, the other academies, is for me a troubling one. I think that undergraduate education at the U.S. Military Academy is problematic. I think it's in deep trouble at the moment. And I think that one ought to worry about that as a model. After all, if one looks at the origins of the curriculum at West Point, it's a civil engineering curriculum. Primarily, that no longer, I think, seems to be the most adequate training for military officers. I think there is no model curriculum for people who are headed for public service in the way that you or I define it. And what it comes down to, I think, is simply a recruiting mechanism for people entering public service. That's fair enough. But I don't see what is to recommend the particular educational experience. And in that regard, let me say that, you know, we know a lot about, now an increasing amount, about educational outcomes. And I think the test ought to be whether the kinds of educational outcomes that you seek can be produced by the kinds of curricular programs that you intend to put in place. I would also ask, by the way, where you think you're going to recruit a faculty for this and what kind of impact a faculty recruited for this purpose is likely to have?
They're great questions, and I welcome the opportunity to discuss them. I think basically what's happening here is what you're hearing is what's happened in higher education over the last 40 years, and I think it's part of what explains, as President Durden was talking about earlier, how we've lost our way in American higher education. We've gotten away from a civic mission. We've gotten away from this idea that there is such a thing as a responsibility on the part of higher education to prepare students for something more than just getting their degree, that they should be preparing for democracy, preparing for citizenship, preparing for service. And what's happened in the last couple generations is that higher education, by and large, has seen students more and more as customers, rather than future leaders or future citizens. These are customers to be appeased and supported and whose desires are to be met. So requirements have dropped away one by one, slowly. So that at my university, Duke University, when I went, there was a grand total of one course
everybody had to take, a university writing course taken freshman year. Now, that may be the extreme, although actually there are some that have no required courses. So what that means is that a student graduating from Duke University has nothing in common necessarily with another student graduating from Duke University. There's little culture that binds them together. In its place, what happens is, at a place like Duke, and I pick on Duke just because I went there. Duke is not exceptional in this. I think there are a lot of schools that are like this. In its place, the culture revolves around sports, right? That's what students share is basketball. Our football team, I don't think, has been good for several decades. So it's basketball at Duke. But there's no binding culture. There's no binding experience. There's no common framework for the academic experience. And we think that's important. We don't pretend that there's one kind of curriculum for public service. But we do think that every college makes a very important statement about what it thinks it's important that students learn through the construction of its curriculum. That's why curricular task forces on any university, you know, often take years of argument just to make some one or two little changes, because it's very important. It sends a powerful message about who, what that university stands for. And so we think that a core curriculum is very important, and that there should be a common framework that all students understand and share. So we don't shy away from that. Nonetheless, we don't think that, again, this is the only kind of curriculum, and that this should be imposed upon all 3,000-some colleges or universities around the country. Each college should have its own culture. And one of the things that the military academies do very well is create a culture of service, a culture of service above self, where students understand that they are future military leaders, and as such, they have to think primarily about the nation and think primarily about leading and leadership. And I would encourage members of this audience to go to the military academies, see for yourself. I think they're incredible. When I was at Duke, you know, I thought that, you know, all kids at West Point, they were just robots. They're just learning how to take orders. They don't think for themselves. There's no creativity. And I was about as wrong as you could be about the military academies. Those kids are they're kids like anybody else. They may take the same courses, but they don't interpret things the same way. They have the vast range of opinions. But what's amazing about them is the culture that binds them together, and that culture that is deeply ingrained in them that says, what I'm doing matters to this country, and I will give it everything that I am. And that's the kind of culture that we want to create on the Public Service Academy. I think it's important. And I also don't think that it's only military. I don't believe the discipline and the unity and the spirit and the sense of service, I don't think any of that has to do with war and guns and fighting. We can do that in a civilian context.
Well, I would just comment myself on that, that first, if you consider the Public Service Academy to be symbolic nationally of what we want in our public service, then its curriculum is not just one of many. It's a statement. And we need to think very carefully about what it would be. So either side of the issue that one takes, I think it has a little bit more importance than we're just one of many, I would say. From my own particular perspective, I guess I'm not a particular enthusiast for core curricula, and which bind everyone in a kind of a common sense of what they're studying. And I think that the way that knowledge and the complexity of the world is moving, and probably the demands of public service are moving, a much more pluralistic vision is where I would go. But let me ask our other panelists and folks from the floor to comment on, you know, whether or not there are current programs in place, like the Trumans, like a whole range of internship opportunities and so on. And my own sense, maybe this is just Dickinson, but I really don't think so, is that student interest in these opportunities is actually quite high. Truman doesn't have trouble finding talented students who want to do it, that in fact the pool is larger than those that are awarded. The same is true for internship opportunities in Washington and working with multiple federal agencies. And so aren't we in a situation where, in fact, that a much more pluralistic approach to this might work a bit better? And what are the vehicles that might harness let's say, given a public service academy, still won't be enough students, harness the broad interests of students across our institutions in these kinds of opportunities in public service?
Well, I actually think that that there are things that have come up today already in terms of changing loan repayment. There are various programs that could be instituted that would perhaps put a better spin on public service. But I totally agree that I think public service is very broadly embraced by students today. There's a lot of interest. There's a lot of competition for they're very prestigious scholarships and fellowship programs that are not lacking for very, very strong candidates. I think there's a real motivation to public service. I mean, you referenced the change in society that has occurred, and perhaps that has happened, but I don't think implementation of a public service academy, which would be akin to a military academy, is going to change that. I think the change is actually going to occur within the broad array of higher education and even the K-12 system leading to higher education. That's the kind of change, because you're looking for culture change, and it doesn't happen with a few thousand people a year. It takes time, but it takes millions of people.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But also, I mean, I think change is happening. I don't accept Chris's characterization of higher education at all. I mean, I think that there are a lot of problems. There are a lot of good things happening, and the dominant move over the last generation really has been to reconnect with civic engagement as the goal of higher education, and all of the places we're associated with are doing that in one way or another. Bill mentioned Campus Compact, which is now broadly accepted across the country. There are many efforts moving in this direction. I think, frankly, what's really changing now, and there is a demand from students, one of the reasons it's been so heavily in the private sector, in the not-for-profit sector, is that, to be perfectly blunt, a lot of our students haven't wanted to go to work for the federal government in recent years. I think more of them are going to want to go to work for this government. Mm-hmm. That's a choice. Students aren't dumb. Government sends signals. And when you say, you know, there's widespread talking down of government, that's true. That has, after all, been the ideological move that one party in this country has made. We have to fight against that. But the way to fight against it is to prove that government can do good, that government does serve the people, that government isn't the enemy of the people, and that's what one political party has been telling us. So to me, that's the big problem now, and the opportunity is that with a new administration that I think is going to be much more welcoming to students in college now, I look for a new generation of service voluntarily.
Well, I guess one thing that I would say is I would reject this dichotomy that somehow it's either the public service academy or a more pluralistic approach. I would say the public service academy is a more pluralistic approach, because here's this option that doesn't exist now, and why not add it to the whole range so that it can not only be a symbolic institution that will help raise the visibility across the board so that students who go to Dickinson and Princeton and the University of Maine hear and think about public service in a different way, so maybe they go there with a different seed planted, which I think would be important. So why should we limit that? I think this is part of the pluralistic approach. Now, I'm heartened. I love the fact that the Obama administration has been swamped with 300... 1,000 applicants for jobs. I think it's fantastic. I don't pretend for one second that this is necessarily going to last forever. I don't think that this is going to address the shortages, because many of those young people want to work, you know, next door to Barack. You know, they want to be in his orbit. They don't want to work for the VA in rural Montana. They don't want to work in rural areas, in the places where we have shortages. They often are not interested in some of the fields where we have the shortage. They're often not able to. You know, the State Department has tremendous needs for Arabic speakers. Well, our colleges aren't producing enough of those Arabic speakers. And they're trying, and there have been movements in that direction. But as I hope folks in higher ed would concede, it is very difficult to implement changes, even the most commonsensical, smart changes. It's very difficult to implement them on a college campus because there are so many vested interests.
There are alumni who have a certain vision of the campus that existed, you know, 50 years ago when they were on campus. And it's very hard to implement changes. You can implement those changes when you build an institution because you build it right in. And so I actually think, you know, people say, oh, gosh, building a new university from scratch, that would be so hard. I actually think it would be harder to implement some of the kinds of changes that you envision on a widespread basis in existing institutions. Now, you mentioned Campus Compact. I think Campus Compact is great. The former head of it, Elizabeth Hollander, who ran it for 10 years, is a big supporter of ours, helped us develop our blueprint. And she'll tell you outright, she tried for 10 years to get folks to implement certain changes. It's a lot easier to get a college president to say, yeah, I'm on board, I'm all about service and civic education. It's a lot more difficult to get those changes actually implemented. And not because there's a lack of will, but it's just very difficult to overcome the vested interest. Now, I'm the first one to say the Public Service Academy is not the end-all, be-all, is going to solve all of our problems in the public sector. Not at all. We want to embrace this larger change so that young people at the University of Maine and at Princeton and all these other places would get more involved. And I would encourage Princeton. You know, Princeton's got the service Scholars in the Nation Service Program. That's great. But Princeton's got an endowment of almost $3 million per student. Don't you think they could afford to do more than just... How many students did you say? How many juniors are in the scholarship?
Six.
I'm sorry to put you on the spot here, but I think Princeton could afford to create a much larger Scholars in the Nation Service program. And I don't want to be hard on Princeton because Princeton's taking the lead on this. Where's Harvard? Where's Duke? Why don't we create this scholarship program? If we think these programs are so important, why... What's stopping us? What's stopping Dickinson from creating the same thing?
Yeah, well, okay, there's a lot there to talk about. I just have to say that I too disagree with the characterization of higher education, and to choose just the specific that you chose. You know, if you're looking at where the Arabic speakers and the Arabic trained people are going to come from, I'm sorry, there are going to be large numbers being produced by colleges and universities right now. And as I look at the curriculum for the Public Service Academy, they're not going to be coming from there because it doesn't fit very well. But that's a separate point. Let me open the floor to questions, comments. And we have about 2 or 3 minutes. Yes? 5 minutes, a little more. In the back.
I'm Hal Saunders, Princeton 52, an honorary degree from Dickinson and half a career in the government, Assistant Secretary of State, and another half of a career in the NGO world. What I say is not intended to be an alternative to anything that's said here, but to broaden the discussion a bit. I think there is a requirement on the demand side of this equation. I entered the government through a career trainee program. I had a PhD at the time, and I learned a heck of a lot that wasn't going to be taught on any liberal arts campus. And I say that with deep respect for my liberal arts campuses. But I think a more fully funded set of programs in government agencies could provide exciting opportunities for young people if they were pitched at an intellectual level that was reflective of the intellectual components of the true mission, not the mechanics of it, but the true mission of those departments. So I just want that to be in the equation here. I don't think we're all putting all the burden on the colleges or on the Public Service Academy. Thank you.
I think you're right. The Presidential Management Fellowship is an excellent program, but it's also very small. White House Fellows, again, highly prestigious, highly competitive, very small. I think you're absolutely right. And there are lots of things that need to be done on the federal government in particular side in terms of recruitment policies. You know, why does it take 9 months for a student to hear back from you know, his or her application? And that discourages people. Rewarding policy, promotion policies. You know, how do we reward talent? All these things need to be part of the equation, too. You're absolutely right.
Other comments, questions?
conversation. And too often we get stuck in either or places. But one of the things that I think is key is we're talking about rewarding. It's about perhaps changing reward structures, and we reward what we value. If we really value public service, then we will reward it properly. And so I think opening the conversation would be, how might we reward it? Because our students, they're not being educated in a vacuum. The culture has told us over several decades about what's important and what we value. And so we said we valued the acquisition of things, money and things. And so get an education so that you can acquire as many things as possible and as much money as you can get. That is not what public service is ever going to be about. And when you make public service, government service, the enemy, those bureaucrats who are just wasting our money in Washington, then we tell young people that is not a valuable career, and that there will be no honor in that. And so you may toil in it as long as you wish, but there will be no honor and no prestige. And, students are human beings like the rest of us, and we would like to feel, certainly gratified by the work that we do. And so we need to change the reward structure and the way we talk about public service in this country and what it is that the government can and should be doing for citizens and how citizens might, in fact, work with the government. And so rather than do we need a public service academy or not, and, for symbolism and prestige and that sort of thing, because the reward structure is no tuition, no loan bills when you graduate, that's a really attractive reward system. But if we're really talking about expanding this, then how might we broaden, as Hal Saunders has said, how might we broaden the conversation to include a reshaping of the way we talk about and think about public service in this country and how we value it?
Could I say something about that, Neil? I mean, I'm very sympathetic to that. I would put it more broadly, though. I don't think the primary problem here is public service. I was talking to Mark Guerin about this last night. I think one of the things we need at the moment is for presidents and other educational leaders to do something they haven't been much doing, which is to step up and use the bully pulpit that is available to them. I think we need to say to our students that having a yacht and two summer homes is not the goal of life, and that preparing to go to work for Goldman Sachs or McKinsey is not ought not to be the only things that they consider when they think about what they do after graduation. We haven't been saying that to them. I think we have to say to them that what Bill said initially, that undergraduate education is about preparation for citizenship, that citizenship is about leadership among other things, and that we need them to think hard about how we can work with them to consider a much wider range of goals for themselves and for the society. I think that's always sort of in the background in good liberal arts education, but it needs to be pushed forward, and it's only going to happen if the heads of our institutions take some real responsibility to do it. We have to confront it directly.
I would go a little bit further. I mean, I agree that there more can be done from the bully pulpit, but, every May, I kind of laugh because I read the graduation speeches from all these universities, the Duke, Princeton, everywhere else, and the message is always the same. It's never go work for Goldman Sachs. It's always about the values of citizenship and giving back to your country, giving back and all this stuff. While they're talking to students that they know full well are about to go off to Goldman Sachs and everywhere else. And so what I would say is that it's not enough to just use the bully pulpit and talk about this. I think it's important. I think that's essential. But you can't just say at the end of 4 years, say, well, now we haven't really told you much about this. We haven't structured the curriculum or the culture of our campus to encourage this. But now I hope you'll think about doing some community service and public service when you go out from here. I think it's got to be built into the mission of the college and the culture of the college during the 4 years on the campus. I think just talking about it is part of the problem. People, they're like two levels of conversation. Everybody's talking this, or two levels. There's the conversation topic, which everybody talks about the importance of service, and then there's the reality. And part of it's related to what you were saying in terms of the rewards.
these kids know, hey, I could go into to Goldman Sachs and get six figures right away, or I could do public service and never reach that level. And that's a serious reality.
Well, the six figures may not be a serious reality right now, but I think we've come back full circle back to the question of really, regardless of whether it's at a public service academy or existing colleges and universities, how do you think about building public service and an orientation toward it into the curriculum? And there is, as I hope our panel has demonstrated at least, there's a lot to be talked about and a lot to be thought about. So I want to thank all of the panelists, and we'll take a brief break before our next speaker.